Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Marcos Hippi.
On today's show, we'll be meeting writer, academic and broadcaster Shahida Bari. She'll be discussing her new book, Dressed, and telling us what our clothes say about us.
Hopefully good things. We'll also be hearing from Sammy Harkham, editor of Kramer's Ergot, the anthology that collects some of the world's most forward-thinking comics and illustrations.
And we'll be hearing from photographer and artist Vladimir Antaki, whose project The Guardians celebrates local shopkeepers found in cities ranging from Beirut to Montreal.
That's all coming up, plus Monaco's Yolingo Fan will be looking ahead to the next week's news, and we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24.
So, Fernando, nice to catch up with you. What has been the highlight of your week at Midori House?
Well, I interviewed the director of a new documentary on Netflix, The Edge of Democracy. The interview was played on The Briefing. Fantastic documentary about the whole process of Dilma's impeachment and apparently a favorite contender for the best documentary at the Oscars next year. So it's creating a lot of commotion, not only in Brazil. So I was quite excited about that. What was your highlight?
My highlight, I think it must have been, you know, it's been the week we all have been waiting for. We just revealed the winners of this year's Monocle Restaurant Awards on Friday's edition of the menu.
I love it.
How carefully do you follow the listing, by the way? Are you going to book your flights to go to Northern Italy now to check out the winner?
Yeah, well, you know what? Because I trust your recommendations, Marcos, because, you know, it is about local food and just delicious. It is not only chasing trends or just having a Michelin star or anything.
And it's a great example that food doesn't need to be overtly complicated. I know, Fernando, that your taste in food is pretty simple. You know what I mean. I mean that the dishes are simple.
You know which cuisine I like, Marcos?
Mm-hmm.
Belgian cuisine.
Really? Which leads us to our next guest, Yolin Goffin, is joining us here for the News Look Ahead.
Yolin, welcome. This is your first News Look Ahead.
I do have a few stories. Let's start off with a more serious note. The G20 summit is taking place in Osaka next Friday and Saturday. It's the first time that Japan is hosting the G20 forum for the governments and central bank governors of the 20 major economies. The big issue at this year's event is the US and China's ongoing trade war. Can it be resolved? Trump has already said that he's going to meet with Xi Jinping behind the scenes, and also that he's going to meet Putin. So we'll see what happens.
You know what's my favorite part of the G20? When they take a picture of all the leaders, because then you can see, I always like, for example, I would love to see kind of, for example, more, you know, female prime ministers and everything. So I think that picture can tell you a lot about the world.
What's been your favorite year for G20 meetings and great photos, Fernando?
Well, I think personally 2014 was a vintage year, you know, for that.
Well, that's definitely something we'll be following here on Monocle 24 as well. Yolin, what else is happening?
Let's head to France next. Thursday this week, a painting by Italian master Caravaggio will be sold at auction in Toulouse, and it could fetch up to 150 million euro. But it has been hotly disputed in the art world because some people think it's a real Caravaggio and others think it's a fake. So that's a lot of money.
Did you ever buy a lot of money? Anything that was fake accidentally but you thought it was real?
Well, it's funny that you say that. I accidentally yesterday bought something in an online auction. I put an auto bid in.
What did you buy?
A wardrobe. I know. I really hope it's by this famous Danish designer from the 1960s. But if it turns out to be a fake, I made a huge mistake.
Yolin, before we move on, how would you describe this painting? If you were to try to sell it to someone, what, like, you know, do you like it yourself? What does it look like?
Oh, it's a great piece of art, but it is it's quite a harrowing scene of Judith beheading Holofernes. So if you like blood and some biblical scenes, then you might hang this one on the wall.
I'm going to have a think about that. Moving on, what else is happening in the next 7 days?
Glastonbury is back. Festival season is upon us. Anyone a fan?
I've been meaning to go there pretty much every year since I moved to London, but I've never managed to actually, you know.
Why haven't you made it?
I've always been
yet?
Just like slacking with buying tickets. I've never really managed to get my act in order.
Yolin, depends who is on the lineup. Can you tell us some of the highlights?
I can indeed. Janet Jackson.
Yes.
Stormzy.
Yeah.
Kylie Minogue.
Yes.
The Cure.
I love how Fernando is so transparent. You know exactly who is performing and if he likes them. Fernando Madonna is performing.
No, I know. But Janet Jackson, that's an amazing. I'll be very curious to see her live. She's an excellent performer.
Are you a festival person, Fernando?
No, not really, but I would like to go more. Funnily, I've been living here for 12 years in the UK, but I think I've just been to one.
And it was Which one was it?
And it was close to London, actually. So yeah, not even adventurous. Are you a festival person, Eileen?
I do love festivals. Are you good with mud, though?
That's the problem. You know, I don't like mud that much, and it always rains, and yeah, there's difficulties with the toilets.
Mud either. I don't like wearing rubber boots and so forth, but my solution has been to go to city festivals, like Helsinki's got my favourite one, it's Flow Festival. I go there pretty much every year. It's walking distance from the city centre.
Well, Fernando, if you don't like mud, maybe the next festival is one that you would like going to. It's my last story, is one happening Saturday this week. It's a battle of wine. It takes place in Ora, La Rioja. It's the annual battle of wine. And it is a feast of San Pedro, two neighboring towns in La Rioja, and they fight out an ages-old dispute. Aro and Miranda de Ebro once fought over some land, and this is now remembered with a day of throwing wine at each other. I'm not kidding.
They throw wine at each other.
A total of 40,000 liters of wine is fired from water pistols on top of around 6,000 people. So you just shoot red wine at each other.
What do you wear in an event like this?
Apparently, I went on the website, white clothes, because you need to look purple after the fight. Here's some pictures for you. Is that something you think is a good idea?
I mean, that picture makes me quite scared, actually, in a way. But I'm sure it's fun if you have a few glasses of wine beforehand.
Thank you very much for joining us, Yaleen. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Shahida Bari. Don't go away.
Academic and broadcaster Shahida Bari's work focuses on fashion, looking not only at what items of clothing we wear, but why we personally choose to wear them.
She's a regular voice discussing cultural issues for outlets such as the BBC, and she'll soon be taking up the role of Professor of Fashion Cultures and Histories at the London College of Fashion later this year.
All that expertise has been put into her new book, Dressed, The Secret Life of Clothes. And she joins us now to talk about the book and what our clothes say about us. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Shahida. My first question to you, Shahida, do you think what we wear is who we are in some way?
Yes and no. I mean, that's a very on-the-fence answer. Yes, it is, because one of the arguments I want to make is that isn't it peculiar that we wear these things so close to our bodies? They are the things that are with us every day, all the time. They are this silent witness to our lives. And very often in our social and cultural and political lives, it's seen to be vain or superficial to be concerned with clothes. But it seems to me we have this really intimate relationship with your clothes. If you, Fernando, take off your trousers this evening, there'll be an impression where your kneecap has been sitting at your pair of jeans, right? Our clothes are really close to us, so how could they not be us? And at the same time, it seems to me too facetious to pretend that our identities, who we are, where we've come from, could be so easily expressed, so reduced to our clothes. And I, for one, I know that I hide in my clothes. Very often my clothes are exactly who I want to present myself as I am, but who I'm not, actually.
I think that's a very good point you make with your own book, and the angle is really original. I'm wondering why, you know, that kind of books haven't really been written before. Because if you look at, you know, what's being written about clothes, so often it's about fashion, 10 things you should be wearing this summer, or alternatively, it's about history of clothing. But you came up with something original. How did you get the idea? How did you decide to actually write this book?
All I did was write the book that I was looking for. I trained as a philosopher, as a literary critic and as a philosopher, and I was reading these incredible works by really famous philosophers, Simone de Beauvoir talking about the body, Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, talking about death, the French philosopher Jacques Derrida talking about his relationship to animals. And I was thinking, this is an amazing way to understand the world. And as a person, I go through life, I'm slightly synesthetic, so I associate colour and texture to images and people and my memories. And I understand the world through what people are wearing. Not that I'm judging them, I'm not judging whether I don't really care whether you're fashionable or not. Sometimes the person in the drabbest item, you know, not mentioning any names in this studio, Fernando, they're the most interesting person in the world because they're wearing that blue t-shirt and those jeans. So it seemed to me so obvious that this was a way to understand the world, but those two things hadn't come together. And I know why that is. It's because a discipline like philosophy is mainly run by men, and they're they're not that concerned about what they regard as women's issues, although it occurs to me, looking at you, Marcus, you know, men do care about their clothes. And so there's a reason why I think philosophy hasn't thought about dress. It's because it's considered feminine, but also because it's suspicious of the idea of appearances, of disguises and concealment.
I guess the next question would be also, why is it considered feminine?
I think that's a really good question. I often think about, my husband is the most is the dandy, he's the dapperest man you could ever imagine. But it, historically, it has been associated with women. And I don't want to pretend that women don't have a special relationship to clothes. You two are very stylish, and I think you probably do think about your clothes with particular attention. But women, I do think, have an extra special relationship to their clothes. And I would say that's because they are so often judged on their appearance, that they're judged on how beautiful they are, how thin they are, how maternal or fertile, or, you know, how feminine they look, that there's a certain judgment or a certain kind of scrutiny that women are subject to. And so they have to think about how they dress. They have to think about, am I going to be able to run home in these pair of shoes if I'm walking home late at night? Mm-hmm. Is this top too low? Am I going to be taken seriously at work? Am I looking beautiful enough? So women, I do think, have a special relationship with clothes, but lots of men do too.
I love in the book when you talk about specific items of clothing. And one interesting one is the suit, which, you know, it's in a way how men, you know, they can kind of hide themselves, you know, when it becomes like a uniform. Can you tell us more? Because I think the suit is such an interesting piece to do some analysis on.
That is the history of the suit. The suit was designed as a kind of uniform for men, and it's designed to make them look homogenous and to stop them being seeming extravagant and exuberant. That's how it comes about. Samuel Pepys writes about it in his diary, you know, that the king has declared that this should be the uniform of men. And what's interesting about the suit for me is that it's become associated with ideas of authority and respect. And it doesn't matter who you are. If you're in trouble, you don't look like you ever get into trouble, you two. But if you're in trouble, you'll wear a suit in a court of law. If you're getting married, you'll probably wear a suit. Bank managers, estate agents, lawyers wear suits. Presidents, prime ministers, have we still got one, will wear suits. And it occurred to me that this is a uniform that conceals. But what most interests me about the suit is its language. If you think about suits, they have ties and cuffs and buttons, that it has a kind of a secret violence to it. And the suit can crumble. I talk about what it looks like, what it feels like when you watch an American president in the back of a Lincoln limousine crumpled because he's been assassinated, or, you know, the reams of shame-faced traders from Lehman Brothers coming out of that building carrying their boxes, that masculinity doesn't always stand up to scrutiny.
Which piece of clothing do you find most fascinating? Looking at the context and what it stands for.
Oh, that's really hard. Probably the thing that I discovered that I didn't know about myself is that I love shoes. I'm really small, as you can tell, so I always have to wear heels. And people who know me will say I love heels, and I do. But when I was researching shoes, I really fell in love with trainers, with footballers' boots, because I started to think about performance shoes. I don't know if you guys are sporty, if you know that feeling. Maybe
Marcus is, actually.
Marcus, yeah. Well, you know, when you put on your soccer boot and your football boot and you tie up the laces and you tug on the tongue of it, and you feel like the potential, you know, this game is going to be the one where you're going to be in complete control of the ball, you know. I just was talking to the director of the film Maradona, and I was watching footage of Maradona darting across that pitch, and he's so small and his centre of gravity is low. And what the football boot does, the boot I write about, the one that I fell in love with most unexpectedly, is Cristiano Ronaldo's Nike Magista boot, which was designed specifically for him, it seems. It looks like an animal skin, looks reptilian, and it's luminous, and it simulates bare skin touch. So it feels like it has an integrated sock liner, so your foot becomes the boot, becomes the ball, and you're kind of almost supernaturally connected to the ball.
I'm wondering that an example, how much are clothes about what they make you feel like? How much is it about that connection on your skin, the feeling on your skin you get from clothes that creates some kind of a psychological feeling?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question. When people ask me, what do you want to do in this book, I sometimes say, I want you to think about that feeling when you put on your warm winter coat on the first cold day of September, and you immediately know what that sensation is because you've forgotten you had that coat and you hadn't realised that you were struggling with the cold, and then suddenly the warmth of that suede or that leather or that padded goose feather jacket does something to you. And I'm really sensitive to those things. I can look at your shirt, which looks like a kind of cotton linen mix, Marcus, and I can see how light it was. It's almost transparent, it's so light. But also that linen might be a little bit abrasive, actually, too, that it might have certain roughness. But that might make someone want to touch you. It's funny how women's clothes in particular, I think, often solicit the touch. They're often, you know, silky or sequined or feathered, or, you know, there's something about the texture that's really, really important, I think.
You know, which fabric, for example, that is these days is very controversial, but fur, for example, it's interesting that it's powerful, it's beautiful, but in some societies these days, let's say here in the UK, if you're wearing fur, probably a lot of people will throw paint on you in the street. So it's interesting how, you know, this piece of clothing, for example, became so controversial, you know, because people are more aware about those fur coats are made and everything.
Yeah, I write about furs, feathers and skins, and the fur is really interesting to me, precisely for the reasons that you say, that it is, you know, unthinkably luxurious. When you see fur, you just want to sink your fingers into it. And if you've felt, you know, real fur, it does feel almost kind of mystical or something. But the philosopher I call upon to talk about fur is Walter Benjamin. He's a German writing philosopher. He was writing during the Second World War, just before... Well, he died, basically, trying to organise his exit from Nazi Germany, and he committed suicide. And he writes about suede gloves, and he says, you know, there's that moment when the animal is against your skin and you suddenly realise the savagery within, that, you know, you've mastered the animal, you can kill it and wear its skin as your jacket. But when you wear it next to you, you realise that you are the animal too. And he's writing about the context of World War II, where human beings are somehow closer to this awful, savage animal nature too.
Shahida, some people think about clothes less, some people think about them more, and I would imagine you've been thinking about them extremely much. I'm wondering, how complicated does it get eventually when you are so aware of all these different meanings clothes carry to different people? Like, for example, when you decide in the morning what to wear, what kind of a process is it?
I know, you're right. It's really hard for me. I wish I hadn't written the book. It's so hard to work out what to wear because people are now constantly judging me on my clothes. But I don't think it's that complicated. Well, I wrote the book not to make our relationship to clothes more complicated, but to alert us to the fact that we have a relationship to our clothes, that actually you are wearing clothes. And I go through films and paintings and music and plays, and I say, look, people are wearing clothes, not just as costumes because they're dressed up, because clothes are part of our life, a really important witness to our life. They're metaphors for our life. And actually, one of the really important things we have to do is care about our clothes, because if we care about our clothes, we might start to care about the people who make them. And that's the spine of my book, to say we're in a crisis at the moment with fast fashion and the ecological crisis. Fashion is one of the most polluting industries in the world, and we really need to start to think about how we look after the people who make our clothes, the conditions in which they make them, the damage to their health, the resources we exploit. It's time to start thinking about that.
And Shahida, one of my favourite things in your book is the amount of pop culture references, which I think you're a fan of popular culture, because there's been...
How could you tell?
Exactly. I love the part where you mention Kate Bush as album cover as well, which is quite interesting what she was wearing with her dogs as well, right?
Yeah.
How important was popular culture that you wanted to write in the book?
Well, it was always going to be a philosophy book, a hard philosophy book. I don't shy away from talking about Kierkegaard and, you know, the hardest philosophy I could find, but the most interesting. I mean, it's not a funny book because it's so serious. It is about taking our clothes seriously. But I did want you to think about clothes in the way that you find them and see them, which is in, you know, this enormous fur coat that Maradona wears in an interview, or I write about Kate Bush, or David Byrne's enormous jackets in his concerts. I do get quite popular, I think. Yeah, Paddington Bear probably is the most popular, because Paddington Bear has a suitcase, of course, when he arrives, and I'm interested in what it means to be a refugee and what you get to carry or not carry with you when you travel.
We're talking about what clothes mean for different people. How do you answer the question why we want new clothes? You write about that.
Yeah, that's a really tough question, and I still think about it. One of the things I suggest is that we want to be things that we're not, that life is full of longing, and so sometimes we wear the suit or the high heels, something that will give us the thing that we're not, or might make us seem like the thing that we're not. Sometimes it's about that. But I also think that sometimes there's an emptiness in life, and that we're trying to fill it sometimes with clothes. And other people, I think, it depends on who you are, of course. I can think of friends who, you know exactly how to wear a brooch on a coat, or how to, some people know how to tie a scarf. I can never wear scarves, but some people know exactly the right angle at which you should tie your scarf or where your belt should be. And those people, I think, are showing that they're responsive to life, that they understand something about their bodies and the way that they're seen, and that they want to respond to the world with colour and texture and feeling.
How culture related are these things, by the way? I wonder, you know, had you been born in Italy, for example, would you be thinking differently about these things?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. We talk about the inherent, intrinsic style of French women, for instance. I've been talking to people who work in fashion studies and dress studies all over the world, and there is a global culture of clothes, right? I mean, the most interesting fashion apparently is happening in Lagos, in Japan. Japanese fashion culture is so different. It's true that there might be some culturally specific aspects to our clothes, but I don't think that any one culture is more stylish than another. And it's one of the most interesting things about writing up my book right now is that we're living in a world where people have never looked more different, racially, of course, but also not just because of fast fashion, but because of the liberated world most of us live in. Most of us live in this world where you can dress up in any way you want. And there are so many different ways to do it. It seems to me so delightful and fascinating.
And coming back to what you were talking with Marcus, it is indeed incredible when you find the right piece of clothing, because it can cheer you up. You can be having the most depressing day. I found a pair of corduroy shorts recently that gave me immense happiness. So would you agree? What piece actually that perhaps you bought recently, or historically that you?
I love that your corduroy shorts gave you joy, and you, as you were talking about it, your face lit up. I think we all have those garments, even if we don't think we're fashionable. Increasingly, I think that it's the clothes that the people I love wear. So I bought, my husband is a real dandy, but he's going through a phase of wearing gilets, and it's really upsetting me. And I got really tired of this one gilet he'd been wearing, so I bought him a different cotton padded one, and it's actually rather nice, and it gives me pleasure to see his pleasure in it.
You write a fair bit about history of clothing, but what do you expect from the future then?
I hope that we're going to find a way to think about the ecological crisis we're in. I think the fashion industry, but also all of us who wear clothes, all of us have to think about our responsibility to the natural world and the resources we use. I think we're entering into a more responsible world. I think it's not just about us either. It's about industry. I don't think it's about overconsumption. I think people buy for all sorts of reasons. It's about overproduction, and we have to find ways to put pressure on industry to change the way they treat their workers and the resources they use. So that's what I'm hoping for, that we'll take clothes seriously.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly, Shahida. And just before we let you go, I'm wondering, you mentioned earlier that you remember people kind of for their clothes. So I'm wondering, looking at Fernando now, how will you remember him when you leave the studios?
I will always remember him for this, like a kind of sky blue t-shirt and the jauntiness with which you wore it, but also your beautiful linen striped shirt. You're both very, very smart.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure having you in the studio. And Shahida Bari's new book, Dressed, The Secret Life of Clothes, is out now. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Time for some new music, but arriving with some sadness this week. French producer and musician Philippe Zadar, one half of house music duo Cassius, died this week after falling from a building in Paris. He was 52. His work across the past three decades has helped enhance the sound of acts ranging from Phoenix to the Beastie Boys, as well as creating his own hits. His death arrives just as Cassius were on the eve of releasing their brand new album, Dreams. So, from that record out this week, this is Don't Let Me Be.
Don't Let Me Be by Cassius, there from the new album Dreams. And that is, of course, dedicated to the memory of Philippe Zadar, who sadly passed away this week. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
From Midori House in London, you're tuned to Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
US cartoonist and editor Sammy Harkham has been compiling the anthology Kramer's Ergot since 2000. It's grown from a personal project into becoming an essential collection for both seasoned fans and newcomers alike, looking to find some of the most innovative and forward-thinking comic creators of our time.
Monocle's Augustin Macellari spoke to Sammy about the latest edition published by Fantagraphics, and he began by asking how the idea of creating a comics anthology first began.
I'd say there's the desire to make comics as a teenager, and not knowing how to do that, not knowing how to make a book by myself. So it just seems like working with other artists was the way to go. Just naturally just seemed like a logical way of putting together a book, you know, gather your friends together and to slowly start figuring out how to make comics. Because I think when you start making art, you're sort of maybe slightly directionless in terms of having a voice of your own. So the anthology initially started as a way of like, I just want to publish, I want to make stuff, I want to put it out there. And it evolved, you know, so from issue to issue, I'd say every time I finished an issue, I'd say, that was it. I'm never going to do it again. I don't want to do it again. But there'd always be a new reason, a new angle, sort of a new take that made it interesting to me. Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, I think it does a bit. I mean, I'm interested to hear, you know, this kind of adolescent interest in making comics. There's a lovely intro at the beginning of this edition by Jaime Hernandez, who talks about his family's background of kind of enthusiastically consuming comics, starting with Marvel comics and then kind of finding alternative stuff from there. And, you know, for you, were you coming from a position of superheroes initially, or did you start to get into it with an awareness of more underground sort of alternative things?
Yeah, my trajectory is very similar to most people in the US, where it's superhero comics and then hopefully you discover more alternative or art comics, where you discover, you know, your older brother's copies of Zap or something. So that was my trajectory for sure, from superhero comics till I was around 13, 14, then discovering punk rock music, losing interest in the comic book store, but heading over to the record shop and finding zines and comics like Peter Bags Hate, Klaus's 8-Ball. And so then you started seeing comics in this other context of counterculture, of a sort of more snotty culture in a way. And so it just seemed like a natural growth from there. You know, when I was getting into comics in the mid-90s, it was this incredible time for like misanthropic, very craft-driven, self-taught, idiosyncratic work. If we think of like Julie Doucet's Dirty Plot and Chester Brown's work, and there was just so much great material. And to me, it was like the ultimate medium. You know, the Jaime Hernandez piece that starts the issue, I felt like is a roundabout way of really speaking towards why make an anthology? Why are we cartoonists? Why are we so engaged with this medium? You know, I think the thing that you get from Jaime's piece is like, you don't even have a choice. You know, if you're drawn to this medium as a maker, you're so... it's completely logical. You're just so deeply in love with it, you know? And so at this point, doing Kramer's seems like an irrational act, you know? But I do think comics are this incredible medium for getting directly into a person's brain, you know, from the brain down to the hand and what comes out of that. You know, when I look at someone's work, I feel like I'm going right into their... you know, their deepest part of themselves.
Can take you into some pretty dark places. The Johnny Ryan comics that you always have. That's a look into the heart of darkness there. But they're funny as well. And that's a thing that I wanted to pick up, is that, you know, you offer this balance of very puerile stuff often. There'll be lots of willies, lots of bums, and it's kind of silly. But then also there's a lot of real poignance. And I wanted to ask a bit about when you're putting these anthologies together, how you balance that, because that's the two ends of the comic spectrum, right? And obviously there's a huge amount in between. It's not to say that it's limited to those two binary poles, but you span it. And what's the process like for kind of making sure that it's harmoniously balanced in that respect?
Well, it goes back to what I was just saying. I think if you're looking, if the main thing that really gets you excited about comics as a medium are personal voices, you know, idiosyncratic vision, one that doesn't seem to take in the outside world at all as a consideration, something like Johnny Ryan fits in very well next to something like Chris Ware, in my view, because at the end of the day, they're doing something similar in that they're connecting very deeply with their own sort of psyche, you know? So I can't start an issue saying, well, it's only going to be literary stories, or it's only going to be memoir as sort of, you know, something smarter and a little bit more considered, or this thing's going to have more puerile work. I think you put the word out there and you just start gathering material. And as you gather it, it starts taking its own sort of life. You know, it becomes this Frankenstein monster of that you start adding to and building and sometimes subtracting from, you know. And you're just trying to build this thing. Sometimes it looks sillier than you initially thought it would be. Sometimes it looks more serious. You know, so does that, I mean, hopefully that helps guide it, like at least as far as answering your question.
I think it does. I mean, I suppose it's almost like a mixtape, isn't it? It's that, how do you put together something that accurately communicates?
Yeah, and you can't design something like that from on high. You can't have this, like, this is the theme, this is the tone, and then hit your page count and be like, we're done. That's a bad way. I think you have to approach it like an author making your own book or your own piece of art, in that, like, you start with a notion. These are all ideas. They're vague and you don't know what they mean. You don't know what the themes are. You're just sort of following various ideas. You know, Jaime's piece is very clear to me now what it does, but all I knew is that for years, as I was working on the issue for the last 2-3 years, I just knew I wanted something, you know, and I was about finding the right thing that could, something specific, talking specifically about one piece of art that somehow talked about everything. And I didn't even know why I wanted it. But of course, as I send the book to the publisher, I can start seeing all these thematic ideas. And I think that sort of approach works with, like, curation. Like, you start gathering material. And you can't be too dogmatic, I think, about, like, what definitively makes a good comic or what doesn't, beyond trying to get that, you know, that thing that feels honest and genuine and deeply felt.
That's really interesting. I mean, having just said that, it's a hard thing to pin down. I mean, is that where it comes from? Is it a kind of, is it an integrity? Is it the mark of a good comic, one in which you do feel that connection between the page and between the images and the text, and you feel real intent on the part of the artist?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you consider the wide range of artists that have been published in Kramer's, the only thing that probably unifies them is that they all seem to have very singular voices. You know, it doesn't feel like work made by a committee. It doesn't feel work made as a job or as something that had to get completed for, you know, a paycheck or something like that. And that's why I think you can look at a comic strip like Nancy and it feels weirdly connected to a comic by Lale Westvind. You know, like, there are these weird, like, there's generations between them. The context in that the work was created are completely different, but they both feel like art made by a person where they had this, it's beyond a need, it's a necessity to do it. You know, it feels like you're seeing them on the page more than the actual physical person. And I feel like my job is to just create a space where all this stuff makes sense together, you know? So it doesn't feel like a hodgepodge of just, you know, random stuff thrown together. It should feel cohesive, you know, because what you're really trying to do with an anthology like this is to create a vision of comics. You know, a vision of, like, where this, what is this medium, you know, or at least a vision, you know, not definitively like the vision, but a vision of comics, you know, so you can discover stuff and hopefully it allows the reader to lean in, you know, where we're not holding your hand and that you have to invest a little bit. You know, I get a lot of complaints about, you know, often issues don't have table of contents or the table of contents are hard to read. And I just think, like, if you really want to know who one of these artists are, like, pay attention, you know?
yeah.
Like, that's good. I feel like that's, like, in this day and age, it's like a, like, investment is the one thing that the internet sort of robs everyone of, because everything's just sort of out there for us to grab at our leisure. And I just think, like, I can't engage with anything unless I invest in it in some way, something I've read about or something I've paid for or something that, you know, I've had to look for. And I value that. Like, I think that's important. So I try to do that.
I wanted to pick up on the internet. One of the guys who's always stood out, certainly from the last few issues, is Leon Sadler, who's an artist based in the UK. He has spoken in interviews in the past about how important community is to him. And I know that he has this kind of fairly substantial digital presence. You know, he's obviously, Instagram is comparatively recent a development, but he's always had these kind of odd websites. And I wondered to what extent, you know, finding artists like him, how much it was with some of the smaller, not to belittle them, some of the less well-known artists in the collection, how you discover them, whether this is a kind of internet project, at least initially, and whether that then kind of enters the real world as you make contact and as you start thinking about bringing their work together into a physical bookbound form.
Well, in Leon's case, I saw a comic of his that was a Simpsons comic, like a mini comic he made, like a bootleg Simpsons comic that I thought was just incredible. And then next to that were about a dozen other fantastic comics, all formally different, all visually, aesthetically different from each other. Amazing artist. He's one of the best editors as well. He does an anthology with Hugh Frost that is just incredible, called Mold Map, that I think the latest issue is digital only, that you can read on the Mold Map website, which they made specifically for the web. I'm just a reader, so I'm constantly just looking at stuff as a reader. I don't really do open calls for people to submit work. I'm always happy to look at stuff, but you know, look, between Instagram and Tumblr and the internet and going to conventions and festivals, I'm constantly seeing work. And it's look, you know, sometimes there's work that, you know, I find certain kinds of humor work that I like doesn't always seem like a good fit. And sometimes I feel like maybe that's a limitation of the anthology, and it makes me sort of rethink my approach if there's something that doesn't seem to fit and I want it to fit. Especially when there's work that's more on the mainstream spectrum that I'm interested in, because I like science fiction and I like horror comics and I like all that stuff, and I can appreciate and enjoy a lot of mainstream comics too. But Kramer's, it seems like the bar is set at a certain kind of, you know, personal work. As far as community, I don't, you know, Twitter and Instagram, they're nice places, but it seems like a party where it's like made up of like 5 million parties and we're all sort of bumping into each other, and this just seems like people arguing all the time. So more and more I'm getting away from the internet as a space to sort of just hang out in, you know, for me anyway. It just doesn't seem to be a productive place to talk to people.
Given that you've been putting these together now for the best part of 20 years, how do they work for you as a kind of, as a moment at which you can look around and take stock and see? Obviously you have some vintage comics in this one. There's a really excellent Robert Crumb bit, and there are others. Then there are some really contemporary ones, but I wonder, are these a chance for you to, yeah, look around and notice the sort of eddies and flows of what's coming in and what's going out, so to speak, in comic writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the anthology for me always works on a couple levels, and one of them is the dialogue for fans of comics who are deeply engaged with the medium on the same level that I am. So I do feel like part of what Kramer's does is have this back and forth, or is part of this constant back and forth. And each issue to me, like who the publisher is of that particular issue, I think says something. I think the format says something. So each issue is definitely like part of a call and response that's happening.
Just finally, you kind of touched on the lengthy process that it is putting them together. And I know that this is only just coming out now, but have you started to look towards issue 11 yet?
No, I think 10 might, I know, I think, because I think 10 might be the end.
Okay.
I think it might be the end. Yeah, I think it might be the end. Because if, look, I make my own work. My own work takes precedent over everything else, you know, almost everything else in my life. My whole life, my whole day revolves around making sure I work. Doing Kramer's was very much a way of taking the energy and enthusiasm that I have for the medium that I can't put into my own work to sort of direct it towards this project, as opposed to being on Twitter and just talking about comics or, you know, writing criticism or something. And more, I just think, like, what do cartoonists need? You know, as much as I love getting all this great material, I think, God, like, this stuff shouldn't be running in, like, an anthology. These could be books. These could be solo books by these artists. And can't they send this to, like, a magazine that has a larger reach or get them more money? You know, so more and more, I just think, like, cartoonists need places. It would be great if we had a Paris Review for Comics or an N+1 or a, you know, a Granta. I would love if there was some sort of quarterly magazine that you could always send your work to that paid, you know, respectable page rates, you know? And for a minute there, I tried to think of a way that I could do that with Kramer's, but it's just not possible. It's hard for me to keep the quality at the level I want it to be and keep it on any sort of regular schedule. And then to get good page rates means you have to sell ads. So then I realized, like, I just can't do this unless I made it my full-time thing. So I think a lot of that energy or enthusiasm I have for the medium could be better served working on editing other books by individual artists, both living and dead, and still doing stuff. But, you know, so I'm not working on issue 11 right now. I may, who the hell knows, right? I mean, that's why I don't want to say it's the end definitively, because I'm like, you might see something amazing where the only place it makes sense for it to run is an anthology, you know? And then if that's the case, then I'm off and running and I'm working on issue 11.
Sammy Hockham there speaking to Monocle's Augustin Macellari. And Kramer's Ergot number 10 is available from fantagraphics.com. Head to the website to track it down. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Everyone has a preferred local shop, but photographer and artist Vladimir Antaki has favorites all around the world. His photographic project, The Guardians, documents shopkeepers whose small businesses are a staple of our high streets, but are in danger of disappearing. His images have been shown in galleries across the globe and are also now a book of the same name. He spoke to Monocle Stonehall about The Guardians.
I was in New York City, summer of 2012, and I noticed this man looking in my direction. He was not looking at me per se, but he was looking in my direction. And I realized that no one was noticing him. He worked in a bodega, you know, this place where people buy candies and magazines before taking the train. So I just shot a portrait of him, and then just to secure my shot, and then I asked permission to take another one. And I took his information and I left. A few weeks later, I started documenting other shops in Montreal and then in Paris. I decided to focus on this series and travel to Europe. So I went to England, I went to the Netherlands, to Germany. I even went to Lebanon at that time. And during 3 months, I only spent time with those shopkeepers and artisans and took their portraits. At first, I didn't really write down a story. I just, like, photographed them. It's when I went to Mexico City that I started, like, recording all the stories. The idea was always to pay tribute to those people, because to me they're the heart and the soul of our cities. If you go to a place, like, I don't know, to a cobbler, for instance, and he doesn't know how to fix your shoe or your bag, he will not tell you to leave. He will tell you, leave it for a few days and I will find a way to fix it, because they're passionate about what they do, their craft, you know? So if you go to a mall to have something fixed and they don't know how to do it, they will not take a chance. They will not tell you, like, they're afraid to damage your item, you know? Those people are not afraid. They like the challenge. It's their passion. They've been doing it for years and decades and from generation and generations, you know? To me, it's very unfortunate that they are slowly disappearing one after the other. So I wanted to pay tribute. So this book is, yes, it's a photo book, but it's not a photo book per se, because you have text and it's also an anthropological document.
Let's talk about some of them. I mean, I'm looking at now Jacques Leopold in Paris. I mean, what's his story?
So Jacques likes to be called Leo. His name is Jacques Leopold, but everyone calls him Leo. He's passionate about art. So he decided to open this bookshop dedicated to art books. Like he explains in the story, there's no real organization. Like, how you say it? It's not organized in a way. It's just like first arrived, first placed, and he just stacks them. But he knows exactly where each book is. And unfortunately, Jacques Leo passed away a year and a half ago. His place was really, really something else. I remember the first time I met him, and you would ask him a question and he would answer you, but in his way of answering. You know, he would be very... some people would qualify it as arrogant, but he was not. He was just in his world. And when you enter those places, you have to keep in mind that you go inside their temple, inside their world. So you have to go by the rules of the place. So once you understand how those people function, you have the time of your life there. You can spend hours, you can come back, you can become friends with them. And that's what happens with this series. I often went back to those places and became friends with the people.
Did you ever go into places which were inviting for you with a camera, but, I mean, obviously, when other people just walk by, they might miss. So, I mean, let's have a look at another one. Like, I mean, look at this. This is...
Vudian.
Yeah, Vudian in Paris as well. I mean, this looks like... It looks like...
It's a pile of junk. It looks like a pile of junk. Yeah. You can say it.
It's a mess. That's what I've been trying to get at. Did you ever go... You know, I mean, how do you differentiate between a place that's worth pointing your camera at and a place that's just an absolute mess? I mean, what's the difference?
So I think this is the role of the artist. The artist sees things differently. And my role as an artist is to show what I see the most accurate possible, you know? In the most accurate way. I think everyone who's been to Vudian's place took a photo of the place. I don't think I'm the only one. I'm the only one who took a photo of him probably standing like a king in the middle of his like palace. But I don't know if you can tell by looking at the photo, but you cannot enter the shop. Literally, like when you open the door, this is the only space you have to stand in the shop. So usually you stand outside and he asks you what you want and he will find it for you. And to me, this is the true beauty, because we call it an organized mess. You know, when I was a teenager and I was in my bedroom, my room was not messy, but it was messy for my mother.
Right.
To me, it was not messy. It was not that bad. It was just like organized in a way that I could, like if I was in bed, I could reach some objects that I needed, you know. And I think they are the same. The way they organize their shop looks messy to the general public, but to them, like, they know exactly where to find. If you ask him to find a lens, he will find it right away. It's pretty impressive.
I mean, I really love a picture of a barbershop by this guy Dominique. Tell me about him, because it's not just about the space itself, it's about the pictures on the wall. And we were talking just before you came in here. I mean, there's people in there. I mean, Hulk Hogan is on those walls.
You even have Chuck Norris.
Yeah, Chuck Norris. I mean, when did he start that barbershop? And how long a space of time does that barbershop tell the story of?
It's funny that you mentioned this shop, because this month is the 6th year anniversary of Ménic Barbershop. And he's located in Montreal, and everyone knows about Ménic. He's been around for 60 years. He started this barbershop at age 18. When he was 18, he didn't want to go into construction like all the kids. So he opened his barbershop. He's been around since then. And he used to play hockey and baseball. So he had friends in those like sports fields. And they would come to him. And it became the barbershop of all the people in the sports. So... very famous hockey players, Canadian hockey players, so everyone like now knows about the place and goes there. And he even has a radio show, and he's a consultant for the hockey. Like every time like it's hockey season, they ask him for his opinion, you know. It's not just about the shop, it's about the shopkeeper too, you know.
And tell me about Mario in Mexico.
So Mario was one of the most interesting encounters because it was one of the most difficult ones. I was in Mexico November of 2014, and this is when I start recording the stories, like I said. And usually I do these photos by myself. I get lost in the city and I find those places. But since I didn't speak any of Spanish, I had to go with a friend. And I'm very careful when I go with someone because it's not the same relationship that I have with the subject. I usually connect with them and they agree on letting me take their photograph. And so when you're with someone, it's tricky. You never know how they're going to react. And Mario spoke for 45 minutes before letting me take his photograph. Usually I take the photo within the first 5 minutes, like stranger to stranger. Mario was very angry, was very sad and angry, and he wanted to share his story. He wanted to explain why. His family started this craft in like 204 years ago, and he knew that this craft was going to die with him. So he had to share this his story, and he had to share why he was angry because of how society is now, you know, like his biggest customer was the church, and now the church is only interested in politics. It's all politics. So everything is bought in China, and they don't want to invest anymore. So I listened to him, and then I took his photograph. And I went back the next day, and I gave him a copy of the photo, and he was happy.
How many of these spaces that are in the book today mm-hmm. are no longer actually around at this present time?
Well, the two first stories you asked me about, unfortunately, the guardians passed away. So Leo and Voudin, they passed away. They were located in Paris. I doubt that Mario is still around. I sincerely doubt it. It was 5 years ago almost that I took this photo. And I was very curious last year. I was Googling, you know, I was trying. He's obviously not on Google, you know, but I was looking at Google Maps, the street view, and I was trying to locate his shop because I knew exactly where it was and I couldn't see it. So I'm afraid that he's gone too. Philip is still here. You're looking at Philip. Some of them are like, we're going to be here till the very end. Like, we're not leaving. We're here to stay, like the two brothers, Bob and Mark in Venice Beach.
I'm looking at a picture of Philip in New York City. He runs what looks like a locksmith's.
Yeah.
And that's a very tidy space, as you would assume that a locksmith would be.
It's the smallest freestanding building in New York City.
Really?
Yeah, and he owns it. So he's safe. So what's going to happen is when he decides to retire, his son is taking over.
Do you think that these people are the guardians, or do you think really that you are the guardian, really? Because I mean, those places, as you say, they're disappearing. But, I mean, we need someone to show them that they're there. We need someone to show them that they were there. I mean, really, a guardian is someone who kind of looks after something. Do you know what I mean? And really, that role is something that is falling to you now.
I never wanted this series to be about me. It's like really, really about them. It's a tribute to those shopkeepers. So you're not the first one like referring to me as the guardian of the guardians. I'm very humbled by that. I don't think this is about me. It's more about them and their stories. And as I said, I'm an artist. So my role is to share those stories in a way that people will be drawn to them, you know? So I like the idea of using beautiful images to attract the public, and then they get more interested.
What's the most unusual profession that is in this book, or that isn't in this book, actually? Because
there's one.
Some of them, I mean, you must have taken more photos than are here, but yeah. I mean, what was the strangest profession that you think is in there?
You know what? I don't use the word strange because the more unusual, the better. Because I'm excited when I see something that's not traditional. I'm excited. There's a man, Henri Launay, in Paris. He's 91 years old, and he's a doll doctor. He fixes old dolls, and he's 91. He's very sharp still. Like when you talk to him, he knows exactly. He's not senile. He's very present, and he's probably one of the greatest doll fixer in the world. This is not something you traditionally see when you go to a city. You don't ask for a doll doctor when you go to a city. It's like something like very, not odd, but like different. And I think, this is, you have Denis, you're looking at Denis. Denis passed away a few years ago as well. And he started this old toy festival in his city. And they transformed the whole city into a toy shop. So the fire station would display like old fire trucks. So they would use the whole city and the houses and the shops to display the old toys, and they would transform the whole village into a toy shop, you know. So those people are not only passionate about what they do, but they want to share what they want to share their passion with us.
Marcus, what a great show, and such a pleasure to meet Shahida as well. I think it was fascinating to hear her opinion on clothes in general in such a philosophical way.
She definitely made me think more about the clothes we wear. I wonder if that's going to make it more complicated for you to decide in the morning what you're going to be wearing for the day when you realise all the different aspects of how significant that decision may be.
But I don't choose my clothes in the morning, Marcus. I choose in the evening, actually, because the morning my brain doesn't work. What about you?
I decide in the morning. In any case, this has been All For Edition 520 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Nora Hull. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now it's goodbye from me, Marcus Hippi.
And from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Goodbye.
Goodbye.